Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the third in this series of Robin's lectures. My name is Christopher Johnson, and I'm the son-in-law of the late Lord Robins, and indeed of Lady Robins, who you might like to know reached her 100th birthday on the 8th of October. We only just managed to prevent her from coming here. She could have done, but we thought it was wiser to let her be with us in spirit, which she certainly is. She wants a full rundown of all the lectures at the end, which I shall try to give her. Now, I'm going to introduce Alan Blinder with a quotation from Hard Heads, Soft Hearts. Now, this is not, as you might think, the title of the new Labour manifesto. It is actually the title of one of Alan's most readable books, which was mentioned in the introduction to an earlier lecture. And I just want to read you a quotation. I think it's the only economics book which is actually based around the framework of Murphy's Law, which, as you know, says if something can go wrong, it will. And this is, of course, very prevalent in the practice of economics. But Alan coined a special case of Murphy's Law applying to economics. And this is Murphy's Law of Economic Policy. And it goes, economists have the least influence on policy where they know the most and are most agreed. They have the most influence on policy where they know the least and disagree most vehemently. Well, now, Alan, he pointed out that Murphy was the exception to his own law because he got it right. And I think Alan is the exception to Murphy's Law of Economic Policy because he knows a lot and he has had a big influence on policy. And I think the record of the Fed, which everybody thinks is pretty good in the last few years, probably owes a lot to Alan. So he's going to go on telling you about the interaction between academic economists and central bankers. And as he is both, he's well qualified to do so. Alan.
Thank you very much, Christopher. And before I start, I'd like to thank the LSE both for the honor of asking me to deliver these lectures and for the extreme good manners of scheduling them this week when Princeton University is on a week's break, which would be the only time in the term I could have possibly come over to England for the better part of a week. And for giving me the honor of doing these lectures named for Lord Robins, who was actually a teacher of mine. I didn't mention this two nights ago. When I was a young tyke in the year, let's skip the year. It was a long time ago. It's been a great pleasure and an honor to do this. The first two lectures in this series dealt mainly with what might be called the staples of the theory of monetary policy as we teach them in the universities. These classic issues like lags, uncertainties, the choice of monetary instruments, rules versus discretion. These are the things I've been speaking about. Tonight, in concluding the series, I want to focus on what might be called central banking proper, viewing the central bank as an economic and even to some extent a political institution. So the issues for tonight's lecture do involve economic considerations, certainly, but they also have philosophical, organizational, and practical aspects that arise much less frequently, if at all, in economic discourse. I want to begin with the idea of central bank independence, what it's all about. Well, as you may know, there is a current historical fad, so to speak. Everything seems to run in fads. A fad in favor of central bank independence. And a number of countries have either made their central banks independent where they weren't before or enhanced the authority of their central banks. Having said that, we have to quickly run up against the fact that the term itself, central bank independence, is a bit vague and has occasionally been abused. So I think it's useful to start with a definition. To me, central bank independence means two things. First, that the bank has freedom to decide how to pursue its goals. And second, that its decisions are extremely hard for any other branch of government to reverse. I think a few words on each of those are in order before proceeding further. When I say that an independent central bank has considerable latitude to decide how to pursue its goals, that does not mean and should not be misinterpreted to mean that the bank gets to select the goals by itself. On the contrary, in a democracy, it seems to me entirely appropriate that the political authorities set the goals and then instruct the bank, and I mean instruct the bank, to pursue them. If the bank is to be called an independent central bank, it certainly must have a great deal of discretion over how to use its instruments in pursuit of its legislated objectives. But those objectives ought to be legislated, and the bank ought not to have the authority to set the goals itself. Indeed, I would argue that giving the bank so much authority would be an inappropriately broad grant of power in a democratic country. The elected representatives of the people, Congress in the United States, Parliament here, should make decisions like that, and the central bank should then serve the public will. So, for example, the Bundesbank is directed by law to, quote, safeguard the currency, unquote, and the Federal Reserve is directed by law to pursue both, quote, maximum employment, unquote, and, quote, stable prices, written in the law. In both cases, however, as you've noticed, as I'm sure as I read those words, the legislated goals are sufficiently imprecise that they clearly require considerable interpretation by the central bank. Taking the Federal Reserve as an example, the so-called dual mandate requires the Fed to give either tacit or explicit content to these vague phrases, maximum employment and stable prices, and then to decide how to deal with the short-run trade-off between the two. That is not written into the law. This interpretive role greatly enhances the Fed's de facto power. But I would argue that it's quite possible to have a highly independent central bank even with much more precisely defined goals. The numerical inflation target of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand stands as a case in point. Extremely specific, very well specified, and the bank is given a great deal of independent authority then to carry it out. The second and crucial hallmark of independence that I mentioned a moment ago is what I would call near irreversibility. Not quite irreversibility, but near irreversibility. In the American system of government, for example, neither the president nor the Supreme Court can overrule the decisions of the Federal Open Market Committee. As I mentioned, I think last night or the night before, Congress can do that, but only by passing a law that the president is willing to sign, or, if he's not, by overriding his veto. This legal structure makes the FOMC's decisions, for all practical purposes, immune from reversal. And without that immunity, or virtual immunity, the Fed would not really be independent, for then its decisions would hold only so long as they didn't displease someone more powerful. Well, having defined independence fairly precisely, let me now pose a naive but crucial, absolutely crucial, question. Why should the central bank be independent? This is not a question central bankers ask a lot, by the way, but let's ask it here. Well, the essence of my answer is disarmingly simple. By its very nature, monetary policy requires a long time horizon. One reason for that is that the effects of monetary policy on output and especially on inflation come with long lags. So decision makers do not see the results of the actions they take for quite some time. That's one reason. But the other far more important reason, I believe, is that disinflation, bringing down inflation, has the characteristic cost-benefit profile of an investment activity. It costs something up front, you pay a price, and then you reap the benefits, but only gradually through time. But politicians in democratic, and I dare say even in undemocratic countries, are not known for either patience or long time horizons. And neither is the mass media nor mass public opinion. And none of those constituencies, by the way, have much understanding of the long lags in monetary policy. So you're constantly seeing, if you're in a central bank, if you make a decision, a change in policy, a constant drumbeat starts about 2 weeks later. Where are the results? Where are the results? And of course, they're not to be expected until much more than 2 weeks later. As a result, if politicians were to make monetary policy on a day-to-day basis, the temptation to reach for short-term gains at the expense of the future, and in this case that means to inflate too much, would be hard to resist. Knowing this, many governments wisely try to depoliticize monetary policy by putting it in the hands of unelected technocrats with long terms of office and insulation from the hurly-burly of politics. The reasoning behind that decision is precisely the same, I believe, as Ulysses. Ulysses knew that he would get better long-run results if he tied himself to the mast, even though I'm sure he strongly suspected he wouldn't always feel so good about the decision in the short run. Although not entirely one-sided, most of the empirical evidence on the question bears out this hypothesis. At least, this is an important footnote, at least for the industrial countries. Once you go beyond the industrial countries, the truth is the evidence is much weaker. Researchers have measured central bank independence in a variety of creative ways, including examining the legal provisions that govern the bank, the speed of turnover of the central bank's head, the nature of its legal mandate, is it focused on price stability, and answers to a questionnaire about its organizational structure and lines of authority, and some other things as well. A common but not quite universal finding in this empirical literature is that countries with more independent central banks have enjoyed lower average inflation rates over long periods of time without suffering lower average growth rates. And an example of that is here. Readable very well from the back. What's shown here, in both graphs, there's a measured index of central bank independence from most independent here, you find Germany, Switzerland, the United States, to least independent down here. New Zealand, you'll notice, down at least independent. This is before, this is a period that ended in 1990. What's measured here is the average annual inflation rate over about a 30-year period. And what's measured here is the average annual real GDP growth rate over the same 30-year period. And you can see a very strong negative relationship between 30-year inflation and the independence of the central bank, and essentially no relationship at all, no statistical correlation between the independence of the central bank and the average annual growth rate of GDP. And for those of you close enough to read the legend, these are all industrial countries, all of them. Well, having given the basic arguments for central bank independence, and they amount to you'll get better monetary policy with an independent central bank, let me now briefly raise a curmudgeonly thought, which I won't pursue, but I'd like to put in your minds. When you think deeply about the reasons for removing monetary policy decisions from the political thicket, you realize that the reasons apply just as well to many other aspects of economic policy, and indeed to non-economic policy as well. Take an economic example. Think about tax policy for a moment. Decisions on the structure of the tax code clearly require a very long time horizon, just like monetary policy decisions, because their allocative and distributional effects will reverberate for years to come. In addition, there is a constant temptation which needs to be resisted to grab for short-term gains that might have negative long-run consequences, such as via a capital levy, which we promise you will only be once. In addition, tax design and incidence theory are complicated matters requiring considerable technical expertise, just like monetary policy, maybe more so. And tax policy decisions, furthermore, are probably far more susceptible to interest group politics than our monetary policy decisions. Yet, despite all those parallels, while many democratic societies have independent central banks, all leave tax policy, right down to the minute details, in the hands of elected politicians. In fact, no one even talks about the idea of turning over tax policy to an independent agency like the Federal Reserve or the Bundesbank. Why is that? Well, as I said, I just would like to leave that as food for thought in your minds, a subject for another day, and return to central banking. So far, I have spoken about independence of the central bank from the rest of the government, and therefore, by inference, from both partisan politics and mass public opinion. This sort of independence seems to be what people have in mind when they talk about independent central banks. And it is certainly the concept of independence on which both the academic literature and the Maastricht Treaty focus. To be independent, the central bank must have the freedom to do the politically unpopular thing, if it thinks that's right. But there's another type of independence that, in my view, is just as important but is rarely, if ever, discussed. And that is what I would call independence from the financial markets. And I say this advisedly with the City of London at my doorstep. Now, in a literal sense, independence from the financial market is both unattainable and undesirable, literally, because monetary policy works through markets. And therefore, perceptions of likely market reactions have to be relevant to policy formulation, and actual market reactions are certainly relevant to the timing and magnitude of the effects of monetary policy on the economy. There is no escaping this, so there cannot be a literal independence between the policy of the central bank and the markets. When I speak by analogy of making the central bank independent of the markets, I mean something very different from that. And this is what I mean. Central bankers are often tempted to, quote, follow the markets, unquote, by which is meant delivering the interest rate path that the markets have embedded in asset prices. Living inside a central bank for a while actually taught me how such a temptation arises. And it's quite simple. Central bankers, believe it or not, are human beings, like other human beings. They want to earn plaudits and high marks from whoever is handing out the grades. Now, in fact, In the case of central banking, the only verdict that really matters is the verdict of history. But that takes a long time to come, and you have to be amazingly patient to wait for it. In stark contrast, the markets, the financial markets, are like a giant biofeedback mechanism that monitors and publicly evaluates the central bank's performance in real time, these days literally in real time. And so central bankers naturally turn to the markets for instant and continuous evaluation of how they're doing. Following the markets may be a nice way to avoid unsettling financial surprises, which is a legitimate end in itself. But I fear it may produce rather poor monetary policy for several reasons, which I'll mention briefly. One is that speculative markets, and these are speculative markets, tend to run in herds and to overreact to almost everything. Central bankers need to be much more cautious and prudent than that. A second reason is that financial markets seem extremely susceptible to fads and speculative bubbles, which sometimes stray far from fundamentals. And central bankers must inoculate themselves against such whimsy and keep their eye on the long-run fundamentals. Finally, traders in financial markets, even those who trade putatively long-term instruments, and in the United States we have government bonds out to 30 years, actively traded. These traders who establish the market prices for these instruments often behave as if they have ludicrously short time horizons. By contrast, maintaining a long time horizon is the essence of proper central banking. It is why the central bank has independence to begin with. Let me give you a stunning quantitative example of what I mean. This is my favorite statistic on this subject. You can take the term structure of interest rates on U.S. Treasury debt or any other country's Treasury debt and use it to compute implied forward rates on debt expected to hold in the future, at any future maturity. So, for example, by comparing the 1-year-old 30-year bond, which is now a 29-year bond, to the 30-year bond, you can read out of the market the expectation of what the 1-year interest rate is expected to be 29 years from today, the implied forward rate, 29 years into the future. Well, when I was vice chairman of the Fed, I asked the staff to do a calculation for me. I said, would you please compute the correlation between daily changes in the 1-year interest rate and daily changes in the implied 1-year interest rate expected by the market to prevail 29 years from now? Now, I'll tell you, I had a very strong theoretical prior on what the right answer, the right conceptual answer to that, which was zero. There is essentially no information in the daily drumbeat of data, practically no information, that is of that durable significance, that it should actually change your views on what interest rates should be 29 years from now. What was the calculated number? The correlation of daily changes in the 1-year rate and the implied 1-year rate 29 years in the future was 0.54 in the year 1994. And the Fed, having a very big staff, I only asked them to do this for 1 year. They did it for every year. So some years it was higher than 0.54, some years it was lower than 0.54. So I happen to know that the 0.54 is not an atypical year. Now, I think you have to be a pretty devout believer in efficient markets to claim that the daily flow of news has that kind of durable significance. I certainly can't believe that for a minute. Rather, I think, traders dealing in 30-year bonds behave as if they were trading, say, 1-year debt instruments. Very, very short time horizons. And notice the extreme irony. The principal reason to give a central bank independence from politics is that we know, or we think we know, that the political process would be too short-sighted. And so politicians in some countries willingly and wisely, in my view, cede their day-to-day authority over monetary policy to a group of independent central bankers who are told to keep inflation in check. But if the central bank strives too hard to please the financial markets, it is likely to tacitly adopt the market's own extremely short time horizons as the central banks. This can create a dangerous dog chasing its tail phenomenon, wherein the market reacts, or more typically overreacts, to perceptions about what the central bank might do, and then the central bank reads those perceptions out of the market and takes them as a guidance about what it should do. In the economist's technical jargon, this may come perilously close to creating a difference equation with a unit root. Now, don't get me wrong, I do not for a minute believe that a central bank can afford to ignore the financial markets. Nor would it want to, because markets convey valuable information, including information about what the market expects future monetary policy to be. During my time on the Federal Reserve Board, I was constantly looking at and appraising the information, as one could understand it, in the stock market, the bond market, the foreign exchange market, and others. My point is rather different, and it is that delivering the policies that the markets expect, or indeed demand, may lead to very poor monetary policy. This danger, I think, is now greater than ever before, because the currently prevailing view of financial markets in central banking circles, it wasn't always this way, is one of profound respect. The markets are seen as repositories of enormous power and wisdom. In my personal view, the power is indisputable, but the wisdom is at least somewhat suspect. Now, in discussing these arguments for central bank independence, I have not mentioned the rationale that is frequently offered by central bankers and academics alike. That is the notion that more independent central banks are more credible inflation fighters, and because of that, can disinflate, bring inflation down at a lower social cost. Indeed, extreme versions of this credibility hypothesis, which have appeared in the academic literature, claim that costless disinflation is possible if central bank policy is completely credible. And the reasoning behind this theoretical idea is quite simple. The essence of an expectational Phillips curve is that inflation depends on expected inflation plus a function of unemployment and other variables and random shocks. I only want to talk about the first. If expectations are rational and the monetary authority has total credibility, then the mere announcement of a disinflation campaign will make the expected rate of inflation fall abruptly and thereby bring down the actual rate of inflation suddenly with no necessity to pay a transitional unemployment cost. That's the argument. Now, I omitted this credibility hypothesis, and not by oversight. Much fascinating theory to the contrary, I don't know a single shred of evidence that supports it. It seems to be one of those hypotheses in economics that sounds plausible, but turns out on careful examination of the facts to be untrue. Like the interest elasticity of savings. Everybody knows that savings is an increasing function of the real after-tax rate of return. The only trouble is it isn't. And in this case, the available evidence does not suggest that more independent central banks are rewarded with more favorable short-run Phillips curve trade-offs. Nor does the recent experience of OECD countries suggest that central banks that post inflation targets are thereby able to disinflate at lower cost than central banks that have no such targets. What it does suggest is that those central banks do disinflate more. They're willing to pay the social cost to do so. Nonetheless, the claims that there is a credibility hypothesis, the claims that a central bank can get a better trade-off by being more credible, continue to be made, illustrating, once again, as if further illustration were necessary, the power of wishful thinking to influence people's minds. Whether or not it trims the cost of disinflation, however, I can tell you from personal experience that central bankers do indeed prize credibility. They view it as a precious asset not to be squandered. And I agree, but not because it makes disinflation easier. Then why, you might ask? What is so good about having central bank, or so important about having central bank credibility? Well, my answer is this. A central bank is invested with enormous power over its economy. And if it's an independent central bank, that power is virtually unchecked. This authority is a public trust assigned to the bank by the body politic. And in return, the citizens of that country have a right to expect, no, I would say actually, to demand that the bank's actions match its words. And to me, that is the hallmark of credibility. That is the true meaning of credibility, matching deeds to words. In fact, when I looked this word up in my dictionary at home, it defined, now this I know, this is American English, but it defines credibility as, I quote, the ability to have one's statements accepted as factual or one's professed motives accepted as the true ones. It seems a perfectly good definition of credibility to me, and something that the central bank owes to the people in its society. I think that's a good definition. Now, if you look at the academic literature, you find that economists typically employ a very different definition of credibility. In a game theoretic setting, credibility is identified with either dynamic consistency or incentive compatibility. The notion is that if the central bank announces a policy and then private decision makers take actions predicated on belief in that announcement, then the central bank must either be bound by rule to follow through on its promise, that's pre-commitment, or have a pecuniary incentive to do so, that's incentive compatibility. If there is neither pre-commitment nor incentive compatibility, then, the argument goes, policy may be time inconsistent, as I was saying last night, and policy pronouncements will therefore not be credible. As I noted yesterday, that is precisely the logic behind modern arguments for rules that would tie the central bank's hands, or for compensation schemes that would give central bankers a pecuniary incentive to behave in the right way. Each of those mechanisms is viewed by economic theorists as a way to produce credibility where it would otherwise be absent. But when practical central bankers talk about this subject of credibility, and I can assure you that they frequently do, they have a much simpler definition in mind, one much closer to the dictionary definition. In their view and in mine, credibility means that your pronouncements are believed, even though you are bound by no rule and may even have a short-run incentive to renege on your announcements. In the real world, such credibility is not normally created by incentive-compatible compensation schemes, and it is not normally created by rigid pre-commitment. Rather, it is painstakingly built up by a history of what? Of matching deeds to words. A central bank that consistently does what it says will acquire credibility by this definition almost regardless of the institutional structure. And conversely, I'd argue, regardless of the institutional structure, if the central bank does not match its deeds to its words, it will not acquire credibility. So, for example, the Bundesbank is believed when it says it is determined to reduce inflation, but it's not following a rule, and its council members have no financial stake in disinflation. Furthermore, this concept of credibility is not a 0-1 variable that's either on or off, but a continuous variable. You can have more credibility, or you can have less. As I suggested yesterday, I think the Fed now probably has much more anti-inflation credibility than it had, say, in 1979, when Paul Volcker became chairman of the Fed. And importantly, it did not acquire this enhanced credibility through institutional change. The institutional arrangements at the Federal Reserve are exactly the same today as they were in 1978. So here's an interesting question to ponder. The academic literature posits that central banks invest in credibility in order to improve the short-run trade-off between inflation and unemployment. But in fact, there seems to be no such credibility bonus. So the question is, why then are central bankers so concerned, you might even say obsessed, with credibility? And they are. They talk about it all the time. Three answers suggest themselves to me, and I think there's something to each. First, many central bankers probably believe in the credibility hypothesis despite all the evidence against it, just as many policymakers in a variety of countries continue to believe that tax incentives can raise personal savings, including my own country. Second, central bankers, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, are only human. They want to be believed. They want to be trusted. They don't want to be thought to be duplicitous liars. Third, central bankers may want the latitude to change their short-run tactics, such as abandoning a money growth target, without being thought to have changed their long-run strategy, such as reducing inflation. To pull off a feat like that without spooking the financial markets, it helps a great deal to have a reputation for keeping your word. A very important example of that happened in the United States in 1983, when the Federal Reserve, under Paul Volcker, abandoned monetarism. It had used monetarism as its holy anti-inflation grail for the previous three or so years, but it managed to abandon monetarism totally without creating fears that it was abandoning the fight against inflation. The Fed's hard-earned anti-inflation credibility helped make that transition successful. Similarly, as I remarked in answer to a question either last night or the night before about the Bundesbank is constantly winking at its devotion to M3 growth. But very few people doubt its devotion to low inflation. And that's what really matters. Now, at this point in the discussion of central bank independence, I think a deep philosophical question arises. I think we're still allowed to pose philosophical questions at the London School of Economics. They're frowned upon in most American universities. Isn't there something in most economics departments at American universities? The question is this: isn't there something profoundly undemocratic about making the central bank independent of political control? Doesn't assigning so much power to unelected technocrats contradict some fundamental tenets of democratic theory? It's a hard question, and my answer is not necessarily. But I need to defend that answer in some detail. So the question is, how can an independent central bank be rationalized within the context of democratic government? My answer is a blend of six ingredients which will start melding the economics into politics. But I believe the name of this place is still the London School of Economics and Political Science. Isn't that right? So I think I can get away with that. First, we all know that even in democracies, certain decisions are reserved to what is called by some scholars the constitutional stage, although it needn't literally be written in the Constitution. And of course, in Britain, couldn't literally be written in the Constitution. So literally or figuratively, the constitutional stage, rather than left to the daily legislative struggle. These are the basic decisions that we don't want, that society does not want to revisit often, and should therefore be hard to reverse. So for example, amending the United States Constitution, which of course is written down, requires much more than just getting majority votes in both houses of Congress. Our founding fathers thereby made it almost, but not quite impossible, to change certain basic provisions of law. Well, similarly with monetary policy, the Fed's independence, which derives, by the way, from authority delegated by Congress, makes it very difficult, but not quite impossible, for elected officials to overrule a monetary policy decision. Wise politicians made a once-and-for-all decision to limit their own power in this way, just as, for example, the United States Constitution made it very difficult to change the length of the president's term of office. Not impossible. We actually did it once by limiting it to 2 terms, 8 years. But very, very difficult. What made both those decisions democratic is that elected members of Congress made them of their own free will, presumably reflecting the public will. So that's one. The second ingredient that helps make central bank independence consistent with democratic theory is something that I emphasized earlier, that the bank's basic goals are chosen by elected politicians, not by unelected technocrats. So for example, when people used to suggest to me while I was on the Fed, and also since I've left the Fed, that the Fed should content itself with 3% inflation, I always answered and answer that the Federal Reserve Act calls for stable prices, not pretty low inflation. If the citizens think that's the wrong goal for the central bank, they should get the law changed. It should not be up to the central banker to tacitly change the law. Third, the public has a right to demand honesty from its central bankers, the point I just made in discussing credibility. In my view, the central bank owes this to the body politic in return for its broad grant of power. A central bank which dissembles or is imperiously silent is, in my view, behaving in a profoundly undemocratic manner. Fourth, the people at the top of the central bank should be politically appointed. When I went on the Federal Reserve Board in the middle of 1994 as a political appointee of President Clinton, I joined at the time 5 other men and women. I made 6 at full strength, the board is 7. I joined 5 other men and women who had been appointed by Presidents Reagan or Bush. None of us on the board had ever been elected to anything, but Bill Clinton had, and George Bush had, and Ronald Reagan had. And so we, appointees, obtained our political legitimacy from the men who appointed us. And they, in turn, got it the old-fashioned way, straight from the voters. And that, in my view, is as it should be. Central banks ought not to be self-perpetuating oligarchies. Fifth, an ingredient which I also already mentioned, should be present but rarely used. And that is that central bank decisions should be reversible by the political authorities, but only under extreme circumstances. So a Federal Reserve decision, as I've said, can in principle be overturned by an act of Congress. And in addition, by the way, Fed governors can be removed from office for cause. These mechanisms have never been used in the history of the Federal Reserve, but America is wise to have them in place nonetheless. Delegated authority in a democracy should be retrievable. The sixth and final ingredient in my democratic stew is closely related to credibility, and I want to dwell on it at some length now. I call it accountability, or perhaps just openness. Because monetary policy actions have profound effects on the lives of ordinary people, a central bank in a democracy owes these folks an explanation of what it is doing, why it's doing it, and what it expects to accomplish through its actions. As I often said while I was on the Fed to my colleagues, sometimes internally and sometimes publicly, it's their economy, not ours. By offering a reasonably full and coherent explanations of its actions, the bank can remove much of the mystery that surrounds monetary policy, enable interested parties to appraise its decisions contemporaneously, and then, importantly, permit outsiders to judge its success or failure after the fact. Now, greater openness is not a popular cause in central banking circles, where mystery is sometimes argued to be essential to effective monetary policymaking. Making the central bank more open and accountable, it is alleged, may subject it to unwelcome scrutiny that could threaten its independence. I'd like to read you a quote from Karl Brunner, the late Karl Brunner, who was a student of central banking, and he wrote the following. Central banking has been traditionally surrounded by a peculiar and protective political mystique. The possession of wisdom, perception, and relevant knowledge is naturally attributed to the management of central banks. The relevant knowledge seems automatically obtained with the appointment and could only be manifested to holders of the appropriate position. The mystique thrives on a pervasive impression that central banking is an esoteric art. Access to this art and its proper execution is confined to the initiated elite. The esoteric nature of the art is moreover revealed by an inherent impossibility to articulate its insights in explicit and intelligible words and sentences. Well, you can tell that Brunner was somewhat skeptical about the validity of that argument, and so am I. I couldn't agree more with the argument that central banking should be more transparent, less with the argument that it needs to be opaque. In fact, I would go further and state that it actually gets things exactly backward. To me, public accountability is a moral corollary of central bank independence. In a democratic society, the central bank's extreme freedom to act implies a corresponding obligation to explain itself to the public. So in my view, independence and accountability are symbiotic, not in conflict. The latter legitimizes the former within a democratic political structure. And nor, by the way, do I accept the common claim implicit in that Brunner quotation that greater accountability will harm the central bank as long as it's independent. That's important. If the central bank makes good monetary policy decisions, it should have no trouble explaining and defending them in public. If it cannot articulate a coherent rationale in intelligible English phrases and sentences, or whatever language the central bank is using, if it cannot articulate such a rationale for its actions, then maybe its decisions are not as good as it thinks. But remember, and this is critical to my argument, I am talking only about explaining the decisions, not putting them up to a popular vote. That's what I mean by an independent central bank. In fact, I would go even further and argue that greater openness might actually improve the efficiency of monetary policy as a macroeconomic stabilizer rather than cause it harm. Since this is a quite unconventional thought, I think I will explain why in some detail. And in doing so, I will return to a point that I raised but then dropped last night when I asked you to give me indulgence for only one evening to accept the expectational theory of the term structure linking short rates to long rates. I want to come to exactly that point in this context. For the fact is that central banks generally control only the overnight interbank interest rate, a rate that is relevant to virtually no economically interesting transactions. No firm plans its investment, no homeowner decides whether to buy or rent, or no one decides whether to buy a car based on the overnight interbank interest rate. Monetary policy has important macroeconomic effects only to the extent that it moves financial prices that matter for real decisions, like long-term interest rates, like stock market values, and like exchange rates. As a shorthand, let me just refer to that constellation of serious financial market prices as long rates, long-term interest rates. But I mean by that also the exchange rate, stock market values, and so on. Focusing on the long rates, the expectations theory of the term structure is supposed to rescue the central bank from that apparent dilemma. The theory holds that any long rate is the appropriate weighted average of expected future short rates, plus probably a term premium. So for example, the one-year interest rate, according to this theory, should reflect an average of the next 365 expected overnight interest rates, each of which one is known today and the other 364 of which will be determined by the central bank in due course. Thus, according to this theory, expectations about future central bank behavior provide the essential link between short rates and long rates. Very nice. Unfortunately, there are two severe practical problems with the theory. First, the expectations theory of the term structure turns in an extremely poor statistical performance. Statistical tests of this theory assuming rational expectations, for example, routinely reject the theory. This result means that the forward rates implicit in long-term interest rates, the things I was talking about a few minutes ago, are remarkably poor forecasts of future short-term interest rates. Amazingly, both academic researchers and market participants are aware of this finding and agree about it. That is not always the case. You sometimes find dissonant views between people in the markets and people in the academy. On this issue, there is no agreement, and I've talked to dozens of people, both in the academy and the markets, about this. Yet, curiously, economists, traders in financial markets, central bankers, and the financial press all routinely use the yield curve, the term structure of interest rate, to, as it is said, read off the expected future short-term rates that are allegedly, quote, priced in to long-term rates. It's as if all the parties had somehow agreed to participate in a kind of mass delusion that the emperor really has clothes. I have to confess I've done it myself. I would hate to have to count the number of times I referred to the short rates implicit in the term structure. That's the first practical problem. It doesn't work. The second severe practical problem with the expectations theory might be related to the first and is crucial to my argument for greater central bank openness. If the gear that links the overnight bank rate to long-term interest rates keeps slipping, the central bank will find it hard to predict the effects of its own actions on the economy. But the reaction of long rates to short rates depends critically on the expectations of future short rates, which are in turn heavily influenced by perceptions of what the central bank is up to. A central bank which is inscrutable gives the financial markets little or no way to ground these perceptions in any underlying fundamental reality, thereby opening the doors to, thereby inviting, expectational bubbles which can make the effects of its policies on long-term interest rates hard to predict. A more open central bank, by contrast, naturally conditions expectations by providing the markets with more information about its own view of the fundamental factors guiding monetary policy. Hopefully, this makes market reactions to monetary policy changes somewhat more predictable, certainly not perfectly predictable, but somewhat more predictable, thereby creating a virtuous circle. By making itself more predictable to the markets, the central bank would make market reactions to monetary policy more predictable to itself, and could therefore do a better job of managing the economy. Now, please don't overinterpret that statement. I am certainly no Pollyanna on this score. Markets have minds of their own and often move dramatically for reasons that have nothing to do with monetary policy. At least in the United States, where the central bank is relatively young, there were speculative bubbles long before there was a central bank to speculate about. So this is by no means the only cause of speculative bubbles. And I certainly don't claim or believe that keeping the markets better informed about monetary policy will render them either stable or predictable. But I do believe that central bankers can relatively easily reduce at least one source of speculative bubbles, and that is bad guesses about their own behavior. Lest you think this is hypothetical, let me give you two strikingly clear examples from recent U.S. history. I wasn't on the Federal Reserve Board in late 93 and early 94, just before it started tightening monetary policy. But I'm quite sure, that the Fed's own internal expectations about future federal funds rates were well above those that were embedded in the term structure at the time, which seemed stuck and flat at the unsustainably low level of 3%, as if it was going to be 3% practically forever. A year later, I was at the Fed, and I know for sure that the market's expectations of how high the Fed funds rate was likely to go in the tightening cycle of 94-95 was way out of whack with reality. Market expectations saw the federal funds rate going as high as 8% and a few higher than that. In fact, it topped out at only 6%. In both of those cases, the markets got it wrong, once on the high side, once on the low side. And in both cases, the faulty estimate of future Federal Reserve behavior was at least partly attributable, and I think mostly attributable, to misapprehensions, misunderstanding about what the Federal Reserve was doing. And in both cases, the bond market swung wildly when these misperceptions corrected, because the market does eventually get it right. Such misperceptions can never be entirely eliminated, but I think they can be reduced by a central bank that offers the markets a clearer vision of its goals, of its, quote, model of the economy — it needn't literally be a mathematical model of the economy — and of its general strategy. Doing so would help anchor these expectations better in some underlying reality. Now, the Federal Reserve, tight-lipped as it is far from the worst offender in this regard. In fact, I think it's fair to say that the Fed is probably more open and more accountable than most central banks are. But unfortunately, the competition in this league is not very stiff. It's easy to wind up on top. And I believe the Fed could and should go much further. For example, when the Reserve Bank of Australia changes short-term interest rates, the governor of the bank issues a lengthy statement, sometimes multiple pages, explaining in detail the reasoning behind the decision and what the bank hopes to achieve by it. These statements are actually intended to enlighten, not to confuse. and could serve as a model for other central banks. The Fed, on the other hand, usually states that it did whatever it did to help sustain non-inflationary growth, whether it's tightening or loosening, by the way. A second possible interpretation of accountability is to take the word literally in the literal sense of accounting for your actions. In the context of monetary policy, this means, for example, periodic reporting of monetary actions and their consequences to the legislature, to the press, and to the public, just as the Bank of England is now doing. Again, central banks vary a great deal in how much of this they do. At one end of the spectrum, there may be little beyond the formal annual report with no public questioning of the central bank governor. A document like that is almost certain to be self-serving, much like a corporation's annual report to its stockholders. At the other end of the spectrum, we can imagine, although I don't know of any concrete examples, a central bank governor who is constantly subjected to public questioning by the legislature, which strikes me as altogether too much hectoring. The Federal Reserve is somewhere in the middle of this spectrum, but, as I said, probably more open than most. Since early 1994, the FOMC has been announcing its monetary policy decisions immediately upon making them, thereby, by the way, abandoning a very long tradition of forcing the markets to guess what the Fed had actually decided. That small step, incidentally, was once extremely controversial and viewed as potentially dangerous to the conduct of monetary policy. For example, Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress in 1989, he was chairman of the Fed in 1989, that a requirement for immediate disclosure of the FOMC's decision, and I quote, would be regrettable, unquote. He claimed, and I quote again, it would be ill-advised and perhaps virtually impossible to announce short-run targets for reserves or interest rates when markets were in flux, and then went on to say that even in normal times, when markets weren't in flux, quote, a public announcement requirement also could impede timely and appropriate adjustments to policy. And so the Fed opposed this idea in 1989. The Fed then adopted the idea in 1994, and now the Fed's immediate disclosure policy is universally acclaimed. Everybody in the financial markets likes it. Everybody at the Federal Reserve likes it. There is no controversy about this whatsoever, and not the slightest impetus to return to the bad old ways. However, so that's a sign of progress. Nonetheless, the Fed still does very little in the way of explaining FOMC decisions. It usually says what I just said it says. Before I served on the Federal Reserve Board, I believed that the Fed could and should offer much more by way of explanation of its actions. Now that I have served on the Federal Reserve Board, I am absolutely certain of it. Don't have the slightest bit of doubt. So I conclude that central bank independence is a fine institution that ought to be preserved where it exists and emulated where it does not. However, as the lawyers say, it needs to be perfected. You know this term the lawyers use? Perfected. One important improvement would be to make the central bank's thinking on monetary policy more transparent. I have argued tonight that such an innovation could both improve the quality of stabilization policy and make independent central banking more consistent with democracy. The arguments on the other side strike me as extremely thin gruel. While anything can be rationalized by some theory, that's why we have so many departments of economics around the world, economists do not normally claim that markets function better when they are less well-informed. And I think we should remember that. I have also argued tonight that modern central banks ought to assert their independence from financial markets just as vigorously as they assert their independence from politics. The United States Congress, for example, did not delegate the authority, quote, to coin money and regulate the value thereof, That's a quote from the United States Constitution. Congress did not delegate that authority to the bond market. It delegated it to the independent technocrats at the Federal Reserve. Following the markets too closely, I've argued, may lead the central bank to inherit precisely the short-time horizons that central bank independence is meant to prevent. There is no more reason for central bankers to take their marching orders from bond traders than to take their marching orders from politicians. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Alan, for a wonderful finale. And what you said about financial markets reminds me of what one of Clinton's staff said when they first took office and he saw how powerful the bond markets were. He said, well, if I die and if there is a new life after death, I would like to come back as the bond market, not as chairman of the Federal Reserve. Well, perhaps he made the wrong choice there. But Alan has got a bit of time to answer questions, and I wonder if I could ask him one which I gave him notice of. I'm sure many of us here have studied the Maastricht Treaty and the blueprint for the European Central Bank, and with which he's familiar. And I'd like to ask him just a comment. Does he think that we're going to have a well-designed central bank? Will it conform to the kind of desiderata that he has laid down?
Well, I think we don't yet know what the internal governance of this central bank will really, the European Central Bank will really be like. It is clear, one thing that is clear in the Maastricht Treaty is that it will be an independent, must be an independent central bank by the conventional definition, that is independent of politics. That's quite clear. And any country that joins the Union will have to have a central of the central of the European Central Bank get together to make monetary policy decisions, I think. Is as yet unclear. So it will be a central bank. I'm not sure we know exactly how its leaders will come to be its leaders.
They'll be appointed by governments.
By governments?
Permanent members.
All.
Or they'll be the central bank governors of the independent states.
Right, who are not...
Who are themselves appointed
right.
by politicians.
Which strikes me as the right thing. The goals are... also legislated, that's the right term, I think it's the right term, in the Maastricht Treaty, which was politically approved by the constituent countries, which strikes me as the right thing to do. I don't, as you know, favor the mono goal for the central bank, that is, inflation is the only thing that matters. I'm quite content with the Federal Reserve's dual mandate, and that's a difference between the charter of the Federal Reserve and the Maastricht Treaty. And the issue that I spent so much time on tonight about openness and accountability, I think, who knows? I mean, I know who knows. We don't know. And it's clear, I think, from what I said. I did not mean to apply what I said about the virtues of openness and accountability in central banking only to the Federal Reserve. In my view, it applies equally well to the European Central Bank. And nobody knows how it will actually function.
Thank you. Questions from the floor? Right, down here.
Yesterday I was showing to you my concerns and doubts about the monetary policy of my government in Ecuador. This morning I had some news. They are planning to go to a currency box convertibility model like in Argentina in the early 90s. So that brought to my mind some questions. First of all, is that something like change the role of the central bank to adjust a rule? And what do you think about the possibility of the spread use of this kind of mechanisms? And what about the reaction of the financial markets?
Okay, the question is about currency board, is what you mean, right?
Yeah.
The question is about the advisability of currency boards in certain countries, and Ecuador was used as an example, and Argentina, which has one, was used as an example, and how this relates to some of the things I was saying about, mostly yesterday, about rules. Well, a currency board is, sorry, you're obscured by this platform, but I'm answering your question anyway. A currency board is, in fact, the monetary rule that changes the central bank into an automaton. And the central bank is simply ordered to maintain the convertibility at whatever rate is set by whoever sets it, by the central bank or by the government, presumably by the government. And that's it. That is monetary policy. So there is then no question that, well, the economy looks weak now, we could use some stimulative monetary policy. You don't do that. Similarly, there is no question if the economy looks like it's overheating and we need a contractionary monetary policy. Unless that's the way the exchange flows are going, you don't do that. And your rule is set the exchange rate equal to the target number, and that becomes the monetary policy. Except for bookkeeping and things like that, you can basically then, basically your central bank becomes a computer. It becomes an ATM, that's the right, dispensing, say, U.S. dollars or taking U.S. dollars as necessary in return for, in the case of Argentina, Argentinian pesos. Now, is that a good idea? Well, I think it can be under certain circumstances, certainly not under the circumstances that face the advanced Western countries, because you're just giving up too much. What are you giving it up for? The reason Argentina did it was a good reason, and it's worked quite well for Argentina, which is they had a history of extremely high inflation. They had tried many ways to get rid of it. It was very damaging to the economy, and here was one way really to get rid of it. They basically, figuratively speaking, though not quite literally, gave up the peso and adopted the United States dollar. And thereby, you get the American rate of inflation instead of the Argentinian rate of inflation. And if you've got, by the way, this is important, and one of the reasons it's a risky strategy, if you've got the reserves to back this up credibly, very important, then you can do that. Now, therein lies the risk. If you don't have the coverage, if you don't have the reserves to back it up, this is likely to invite currency speculators to test the system and try to crack it and thereby make a fortune for their efforts. And so I think currency boards should be used only with great caution, only if you have a very large stockpile of reserves. Hong Kong, I think, has 7 or 8 times coverage or something like that. Nobody doubts the ability of the Hong Kong Monetary Authority to maintain the precise parity with the U.S. dollar. It's silly to doubt it, and therefore it's never tested. If you don't have that kind of reserve coverage, this is a very, very dangerous game to play. And in a small way, though it wasn't the currency board, when the Mexican exchange rate system bumped up against the boundary around Christmas time of 1995, it became at the margin a currency board. It wasn't literally a currency board, but it came as kind of a marginal currency board. And Mexico did not have the reserves to back it up, and we know what happened to Mexico. So it's a dangerous strategy which countries can sometimes adopt for good reasons. But probably, I guess the last thought I should say is, should eventually wean themselves from. It's hard to imagine the advisability of a currency board forever. For a serious large country, Hong Kong is always a special case. Hong Kong might maintain a currency board. Well, Hong Kong's about to change, may be about to change a lot. If Hong Kong remained the British colony, which it won't, it might be rational to maintain its currency board forever, but that's not going to happen.
Thank you for being polite enough not to mention the case of the United Kingdom in the exchange rate mechanism in 1992. Some of us may feel we've been here before. Question up there.
Yeah.
Yes. Let me take the second question first. I think if you couldn't hear it, the question will be implicit in the answer that I gave. That instance of not raising interest rates, did you mean January, by the way? I think you said July. But whenever, it doesn't matter the month, is a perfect example of what I mean in terms of the virtues of greater openness and giving the markets more insight into your strategy rather than just only telling them about what you do at that moment. Because you wouldn't be worried so much about wholesale misinterpretations of where you were going if you had made some efforts to condition market expectations to think the way you think. The Fed does not do that and therefore really is worried that if it raises interest rates 25 basis points, the markets will say, oh my God, that's the first of 10 or something like that. Even if the Fed, even that's the furthest thing from the Federal Reserve's mind. One good way to cure that is to do it and issue a statement that says, this was a say, for example, I'm not talking about any particular situation, that might say, for example, this is a levels adjustment that we feel is necessary for the long term, and there are no current plans. You know, you would obfuscate that a little bit, what I just said is a bit too frank for a central bank. There are no current plans for further rate increases in the near-term future unless conditions should change. You always have to have something like that, which is honest. No. I mean, it also is protects your rear end, so the bureaucrats will always want it, but it's also honest. You must be prepared to change if the circumstances change. And I think doing that would go a long way towards easing these fears, which, as you point out, occasionally do affect monetary policy decisions, and they shouldn't. So that was your second question. The first question had to do with saying something about the practical difficulty of estimating the natural rate and therefore basing a policy around that. I didn't mention. I'm not sure if I mentioned the other day that, I know I mentioned it somewhere, but I'm not sure if it was right here on this stage, that the Phillips curve fits the data in the United States vastly better than in any other country. So this is much easier to do if you're running the central bank in the United States. The controversy now in the United States is, well, might the natural rate of unemployment be as high as 6 or might it be as low as 5.2? Britain wishes it could narrow the range to double that. Germany wishes triple that, and so on. In none of the European countries can you pin down statistically the natural rate to anything like that degree of accuracy. And that makes it a hazard, much more hazardous guide to policy. It works quite well in the United States. Finally, on the sort of sidebar to your question, there is built into that strategy a servo mechanism, which is if you shoot for the natural rate and you're wrong, inflation will either rise or fall, depending on which side you erred. And with a lag, you will notice that. It takes a while, so you do make a mistake, and you will let inflation run up or run down. So an error will be made. That's life. But it will not go on indefinitely if you're operating on this kind of natural rate theory, because you will look at the declining or rising inflation and say, oh my, I made a mistake. And as long as, but this is a big if, the Phillips curve of a European country has the natural rate property, that's a much bigger if in Europe than it is in the United States, the same thing will work in a European central bank.
Right, but another question here.
Yes, so I'm wondering whether central banks should be required to publish their macroeconomic forecast profile after they see if openness is like a beneficial thing.
Yes, the question was, if openness is such a beneficial thing for central banks, should the central bank be required, or should the central bank publish its macroeconomic forecast? I believe the answer is yes. After the fact, We don't have to let people peek into the room while decision-making is still being made. I don't think that's a good idea at all. But after the fact, I should think, as part of its explanation for why it did what it did, the central bank ought to reveal most aspects of its forecast. I think the only thing that it might want to suppress is its own forecast of the near-term future monetary policy. You want to say something about that in a qualitative way, but to actually run a macroeconomic forecast, you have to build in a sequence of short-term interest rates. And the central bank would be, I think, unwise to publish those right out front. But publishing its inflation forecast, its real GDP growth forecast, and things like that, I think should be part and parcel of the degree of openness that I'm advocating. Yes?
Got a question here?
No. The question is, in the case of a banking crisis, or I guess I could generalize that to a large financial crisis of any kind, would I advocate that the central bank's ability to do monetary policy be suspended? That was the question, right? No, I think not. Monetary policy is normally thought of as short-term interest rate policy, and that's central, but also involves other things like discount window lending, or more generally serving the lender of last resort, fulfilling the lender of last resort role, which could add a lot of liquidity to the economy in a short period, would certainly affect interest rates, would affect observed M's and so on. It's part and parcel of monetary policy and is an essential tool for dealing with banking, liquidity, or financial crises. So I certainly wouldn't. What has to happen sometimes in a crisis like that is you bend away from your long-term strategy. You deviate from it in order to get over the crisis. That creates then the tricky situation once you get over the hill of getting back on the long-run path, and there's always some problem like that. But to not do it is just to let the crisis run its course, let the system cleanse itself naturally, as we used to think was wise in the 19th century, but we don't think is so wise. Now, I'll give you a good example of that from my own country. It wasn't the banking crisis, but in 1987, the stock market crashed in October. The Fed was in the midst, or just about to tighten monetary policy, because it looked like the U.S. economy was getting back to full employment, and you start worrying about inflation. And the Fed simply reversed itself and flooded the markets with liquidity and ensured the financial institutions it wasn't going to let them go under as a result of losses from the crash. That meant that in terms of the medium-run strategy, monetary policy was clearly too loose at the end of 1987 and into the early part of 1988. And then when the Fed thought the coast was clear, it started tightening. So in some sense, it made a monetary policy mistake. But I don't think it was a mistake at all. I think it was an extremely forgivable mistake. That crisis turned out not to really make a dent in the U.S. Economy. But in October 1987, nobody knew that that was the case. That's a good question. The preface to the question was that somebody once described to this gentleman, the Federal Reserve Chairman prior to Paul Volcker, as a nitwit, suggesting that he ran a lousy monetary policy. And the question was, how much of the high inflation in the 1970s would I ascribe to poor monetary policy, and how much to external shocks? basically. And I would ascribe a great deal of most of it to external shocks, except you always have the ambiguity of where does the interaction term go, right? Do you put that in column A or column B? So what drove inflation up in the 1970s in the United States was mainly a series of supply shocks, was only slightly, I believe, an overshoot of capacity, so a reverse GDP gap, slightly. So that's an error of monetary policy. But you always have the interaction question is always, what does the central bank do when faced with a supply shock that bumps inflation up? And you could argue, and people have argued, that the fact that the Fed in the 70s let so much of it show through to inflation, took its lumps in higher inflation, it could have chosen to take more of its lumps in higher unemployment and limited inflation. And some people would argue that was a mistake. I'm not so sure it was a mistake. My view is I think the Federal Reserve erred in its monetary policy in the late 70s a little bit, and so shoulders a relatively small amount of the blame for the high inflation rate we had when Paul Volcker became Fed chairman. But the supply shocks should garner most of the blame. So you can see where I put this interaction term. I put it in column A on the supply shock, but someone else could put it in column B on the Fed and have a rather different reading of that same historical episode. Right. But this is predicated on my reading of the quantitative magnitude of the supply shocks, which accounts for most of the inflationary acceleration, and of the behavior of the GDP gap in that period, which, as I read the data, was a quite small overshoot, not a big monetary policy error, in my view. So I don't think he was a nitwit, I guess.
A question in the gallery.
Well, you mean according to the central bankers? The question is, why, according to the central bankers, has central bank secrecy been so important? They will claim, many of them will claim, that greater transparency, especially if forced on them from the outside, say by the political authorities, threatens their independence and thereby threatens their ability to conduct an appropriate monetary policy. I think that's the central argument. The politicians don't understand this. The public doesn't understand this. And if we try to be too open about it, they'll just be down on our backs, threatening our independence. I don't buy that argument, as you can tell from what I said, but I think that is the variance of that is the central response you get from central bankers who argue for greater secrecy.
Right. Just time for one more, right? The back there.
It could be. I'm not intimately familiar with exactly what was happening in Canadian financial markets at the time, but you're quite right. I'm paraphrasing the question as I go. You're quite right that John Crow was perceived and was an extremely strong-minded, inflation-averse central banker that put Canada more than anybody else, although others were involved as well, on this very low inflation course, which it's still which it is still on. It's not unusual for the financial markets of a country to take the attitude especially if they respect the anti-inflation policies of the central bank. And remember, the bond market always cares for low inflation, doesn't care about unemployment. To think that if that central banker in which so much has been invested was to leave the scene, Armageddon comes next. Let me tell you that in the United States, that was the view in the financial market when Paul Volcker left the scene. It is now the view in the financial market about Alan Greenspan. In turn, each of these people becomes totally indispensable, and no one on earth can replace them. And the central banks, the financial markets were quite unhappy when Ronald Reagan threw Paul Volcker out of office, very distressed. And if Bill Clinton did not do it, but they would have risen in total anger, which means bond prices would have plummeted, the stock market would have plummeted, had Bill Clinton decided to bump Alan Greenspan out of office, which he did not. But then someone else comes along, and the markets get over this. And that's, of course, happened in Canada, which has stayed with its extremely low inflation well beyond the term of office of John Crow.
Thank you very much. Well, I think that must be the last question, and I'd just like to briefly thank Alan for a marvelous series of lectures and I think an extremely entertaining and illuminating set of answers to what have been very good questions. I'd just like to make two remarks. One is that what he said, quoting Karl Brunner, about the esoteric art of central banking, this view used to be perpetuated in a very humorous way by a former Financial Times columnist called C. Gordon Tether, who invented a wonderful institution called the Academy of Heatherstoke, which was a place where central bankers would go in order to educate each other in this esoteric art. The outside world was never allowed in, and nobody knew what went on there, except that the food and wine were extremely good. And the other thing I would like to say is that I do hope Alan has the text of his lectures ready and that MIT will soon publish them, because I personally would like to send a copy to the president of the new European Central Bank. And although Alan was not addressing his remarks specifically to the European Central Bank, I think they would do very well to follow his advice, especially about accountability, openness, and the twin goals, employment, as well as disinflation. And I think if they do that, they'll do a great deal better than if they follow some of the other models around. So I hope we shall have your book soon, and many more people will benefit from it than those in this room who clearly have done so. Thank you. Thank you.